What's up, everybody, and welcome to the Lawyer You Know podcast. I'm your host, attorney Peter Tragos, and on this podcast, we break down the trials and cases you care most about so that you can understand how the American criminal and civil justice system works. We try to make sure you understand your rights by answering your questions as, well, a lawyer that you know. So we want to walk you through this process, and we can do it together. Make sure you get in the comments or in the chats to ask the questions that have been burning in your minds. And while this is not legal advice, it's always exciting. So buckle up for another episode of The Lawyer You Know. What's up, everybody? We got into the trial today. It actually started. And we learned a lot. We learned a lot about what the prosecutor thinks the evidence is going to show in this case and how the defense team's plan is that Alec Murdoch would have never done this to his family. They didn't have that kind of relationship. He didn't have it in him. And there's proof of that from just minutes before the tragedy occurred in South Carolina. Thank you so much, everybody who's joining me today for this recap. While we wait for people to come on, I still am going to cut right to the chase and talk about the end of jury selection before we watch opening statements together and react to them and think about how each side is planning to present their case and how each side, what the strategy is for each side, how they plan to use what evidence, and how there are gaping holes right now in their explanation to the jury, because we don't know what evidence may or may not come in depending on how the judge rules. He's reserved ruling on certain things, and both sides have agreed not to argue certain evidence by agreement because they don't know if it's going to come in or not, and the judge is not able to make the call yet. So that's really important stuff here as we begin a trial like we did today with opening statements. But first, hit that like button. Hit that subscribe button. We're getting to 200K one way or the other. Jump on for the ride and let me know how you enjoy these videos. Let me know how you enjoy the time. We're going to continue to do this. We'll usually pull clips of the trial. We're not going to play the entirety of the trial. Today, we're going to play the whole opening statements on 1.5 speed as we usually do to get through them and pick apart the parts that we really want to focus on. Most of the time, I will recap and abbreviate and summarize what happens throughout the day of trial if you're not able to watch it or if you've already watched it. And then I will pull interesting clips to help aid in our discussion. And of course, as always, answer your questions. So before we get to the opening statements, jury selection was quite abrupt today. And I feel very confidently when I say that there was a lot of things happening outside of the recording that we were able to listen to as the public. There's almost no way that what we heard is all that happened. There had to be more sidebar discussions when that went mute and when it seemed like people were leaving the room and when he asked for certain juror numbers to stay behind. I think they questioned those jurors further and a lot of them were struck for cause. A case does not exist, even in federal court. I've tried a bunch of cases in federal court where the judge asks all the questions and we as the lawyers submit questions to the judge. Never do we just agree on all the cause challenges. We always think certain jurors should be struck for cause that the other side doesn't agree with, that the judge has to make a call on. We didn't hear any of those arguments. I feel like they had to happen off camera or off recording or whatever you want to call it, because the way they picked this jury today went way too fast for a case of this caliber with lawyers of this caliber. I realize South Carolina is different. That is clear. The way they did this is different than I've ever picked any jury in my life. And you can tell when the judge picks a jury, you learn so much less about these jurors than when the lawyers are able to ask questions. And they went through, they did one by one juror. Either you struck them or you kept them. You excused them or you sat them, you swore them in, whatever verbiage they used. The defense, I think, used around six strikes. I think they ended with one left, which is interesting because a lot of times defense attorneys will use every strike and then ask for more strikes, which would protect an appellate issue if you feel like there was a juror that got on the panel that shouldn't have and the judge did not allow you to strike him for cause or her for cause and you needed that extra strike and they said no and there ends up being a problem. That's just, you know, inside baseball protecting your appellate issues. It doesn't seem like they got there or were able to get there. The state only used, I think, three. So they had plenty left. Usually not a problem. And if the state loses, they can't appeal anyways for the most part. So Okay. So that was jury selection, and that's kind of how it ended. And I see a lot of you were kind of surprised, or a lot of you were thinking it went really quick too, right there at the end. I thought for sure it was going to take all day today. Not even close. We had time. Brianna thinks the defense is confident in their case. Do you agree? And then Lauren said, how was Buster allowed in the courtroom today? I thought he was on the witness list. I didn't hear them invoke the rule of sequestration. If they didn't, then he's allowed to sit in there. And maybe the state doesn't care. Maybe the state's confident. So that would be the only reason I would think, because if he is a witness in the case and they invoke the rule, he's not going to be a witness anymore. All right, let's get to the opening statements. The state goes first, as we know, no surprise there. If you guys have already watched them, let me know what you think of them as we kind of go through. I will pause to give you my thoughts and on why they're doing what they're doing. And we will also answer questions as we go throughout as well to give us a few breaks. My guess is we're not going to get this entire episode done in 1 hour, but we will try. And hit that like button now as we start the opening statements if you haven't already. And thank you so much, everybody that's joining us. This is going to be an interesting ride. I love getting as many people in here as possible to talk through this, give us their opinions, because you are all potential jurors. So how you see this evidence, how you see it all playing out, whether or not, let's keep tabs, right? Let's keep tabs on what the attorney general's office says, the prosecutor says, and what the defense says. And throughout the trial, let's see, did they hit their marks? Did they prove what they said they were going to prove? Did the evidence come out the way that they said it was going to come out? Or was it different? Or did they misstate what certain evidence was going to say? Did they misstate what certain witnesses were going to say? Because there were some accusations of that in the opening statement. There was definitely some arguments, and there was definitely some, I don't want to call them cheap shots, but there was some pro moves, we'll call it, especially by the defense attorney, doing things that most lawyers wouldn't even try to do. Most judges wouldn't allow, and most lawyers on the prosecutor side would object to, but this defense attorney was the top prosecutor in his jurisdiction, so he knows how this stuff goes. Let's watch it together.
Now proceed to opening statements by the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please court. On the evening of June 7th, 2021, at the defendant's property off Moselle Road in Carlton County, his son, Paul Murdoch, was standing in a small feed room and some kennels they had on the property. About 8:50 p.m., the defendant over there, Alec Murdoch, took a 12-gauge shotgun and shot him in the shoulder, in the chest and the shoulder, with buckshot. And the evidence is going to show it's a million to one shot. He could have survived that, but after that, another shot went up under his head and did catastrophic damage to his brain. The evidence is going to show that Paul collapsed right outside that feed room. And just moments later, he picked up a 300 blackout, which is a type of ammunition, but an AR-style rifle. And the evidence is going to show that the family had multiple weapons throughout.
By the way, they multiple times say the 300 blackout was a type of rifle as well, type of AR. They say the weapon is a 300 blackout or whatever, which we talked about yesterday, and I have no idea. But people were saying it was just the ammunition. It seems like it might be more than that. I'm not positive, but there's a lot of talk of that throughout the opening. And this is interesting. John O'Reilly said, I watched both opening statements. One was superior to the other. We are creating a poll that we are going to play after we watch both to see what you think the superior opening statement was as a group here.
About the property, picked up that 300 blackout rifle and opened fire on his wife, Maggie, just feet away near some sheds that used to be a hangar. Pow, pow. Two shots at him in the leg and took her down. And after that, there were additional shots, including two shots to the head that, again, did catastrophic damage, killed her.
So this prosecutor goes in. He is going to give excruciating detail. He wants this jury to know the severity of what happened. The defense attorney kind of does the same thing. And they both use these explanations artfully to their advantage, which I think was very interesting. And I will say here, there is a camera on Alec Murdoch basically the whole time. And that is not a Lori Vallow type of insignificant or inappropriate type of deal, because if you're the juror in this case, you got one eye on the prosecutor, one eye on the defense attorney, and the other eye is going to be on Alec Murdoch the entire time. A lot of you are already talking about, why isn't he crying? Why isn't he reacting like this? Or when he does cry throughout parts of the opening statements. the juror absolutely watches the criminal defendant or the plaintiff or the civil defendant, depending on the case. They watch the party throughout the entirety. When they explain it, does he react appropriately, or what I think as a juror is appropriate? So let me know in the comments, do you think he reacts appropriately throughout this opening statement?
The evidence is going to show that neither Paul nor Maggie had any defensive wounds. Neither one of them had any defensive wounds. That they didn't see a threat coming from their attacker. And the evidence is also going to show that both Pat, Maggie, and Paul were shot at extremely close range. The evidence is going to show it's called stippling. It's almost like a tattoo that when you get shot very close to a weapon, it leaves marks that the forensic pathologist can see. They were shot at close range and they did not have defensive wounds.
Just so you know, closed caption not available on this video. I tried to put them up.
And the evidence is going to show that the defendant, Alan Murdoch, over there, told anyone who would listen that he was never at those kennels. But the evidence is also going to show from these things that every one of us, most of us carry around in our pockets, that he was there. He was there just minutes before, with Maggie and Paul, just minutes before their cell phones go silent ever and ever. Despite what he told people, I was never at those kennels, the cell phones are going to show otherwise. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Frank Waters. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, and I'll be the lead prosecutor. I introduced myself before. With me is David Fernandez, Savannah Gow, John Metters, Don Zelenka, John Conrad, and Johnny James. A lot of lawyers. This is a big case. It's a very complicated case, and that's why there's so many people working on it. Sitting in, back in the row, we have David Owen, who's the lead investigator. We have Lieutenant Charles Gent, who's one of the agents. Special Agent Ryan Kelly, and Special Agent Peter Dawson. Some of the agents that are working on the case.
I hear some people complaining about the 1.5 speed. It always happens, but I want to mention it again. This allows us to get through it more quickly, obviously. I'm not asking you who has a better speech pattern between the two lawyers, and you can slow down your video. Future, I've got this comment up there. You can slow down your video so that it sounds at a more normal pace. You'll be a little bit behind the live, but that's no big deal at all.
As well as investigator Isaac Toledo is working on the case as well. There's some of the witnesses that you'll hear from as we go through this case. The judge talked to you a little bit about him being the judge of the law. He gives you the law. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the legal concepts before I turn back to those facts. Just remember, though, he's the judge of the law. So you take what he says, but I'm going to explain to you some of the legal issues from my perspective before we talk a little bit more about the other. And the first thing is, right before you went to lunch, y'all all took an oath. Everybody in this courtroom who's got involvement in this case takes an oath. You know, attorneys take an oath to become an attorney, take another oath to become a prosecutor, judge takes another oath to become a judge, witnesses take an oath on the stands, law enforcement take oaths to become law enforcement. Y'all took an oath as well. And the reason why is that y'all have the most important job in this courtroom. Every one of you raised your hand and said that you would well and truly try this case. And it's the most important job here. Because like the judge said, he's the judge of the law, but y'all are the judge of the facts. Y'all are going to listen to what comes from that witness stand and judge those facts. But you also have to be mindful of that oath. That oath requires you to do that hard job, to make that decision, to call the strike when you see it. It's the same oath. It's just as important as any other oath. It might be the most important in this court. The judge mentioned reasonable doubt, and he's exactly right. It's the state's burden to prove this case beyond reasonable doubt. That is a cornerstone of our country. I wouldn't have it any other way. It's a burden we welcome. It's what we want. It's a system that has been well tested and true. And we take that burden to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. And I want to remind everyone that the emphasis is on reasonable. Okay, it's not any doubt.
So this is like so hitting all the normal beats of a prosecutor's opening statement. He's talking about reasonable doubt. He is talking about oaths and how we all take oaths. He's going to get to credibility of witnesses. So he's hitting all the beats. He started out telling a story, giving gruesome detail, letting the jury know this was important and just horrifying. And then he gets to the law like every prosecutor does. And I think he gives a good analogy here about what is reasonable versus just having a crazy doubt or some possible situation that could happen. So very common for what prosecutors do in situations like this.
Is reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt is often defined. Again, listen to the judge how he defines it, but reasonable doubt, a doubt would cause a reasonable person to hesitate to act. And when you hear the evidence coming from this stand about this particular case, I submit to you, you won't hesitate to act. Again, remember the emphasis is on the reasonable. The judge mentioned the charges, and there are four of them. First indictment accuses Alan Murdoch, to which he's pled not guilty, but accuses him of murdering Maggie Murdoch. The second indictment accuses him of murdering Paul Murdoch. The third indictment accuses him of possessing a firearm during the commission of a violent crime, that being the murder of Maggie Murdoch. And the last one accuses him of possessing a firearm during the commission of a violent crime, and that being the murder of Paul Murdoch. What does that mean? What is murder? will judge against an instruction that is the unlawful killing of another with malice aforethought. And what is malice? Malice is a mental state. That's ultimately going to be for y'all to determine as to what was going through Alec Murdoch's mind when he created and he committed these crimes. What is malice? Malice has often been defined as the intentional doing of a wrongful act without just cause or excuse. It is the intent to inflict an injury under circumstances that the law would presume an evil intent. An evil intent. And when you look at the circumstances of the crime, when you look at what led up to this crime, the evidence is going to show that there was malice aforethought. Aforethought, what does that mean? It means it has to exist at the moment you commit that crime. It doesn't have to be planned. It doesn't have to be planned for any long period of time. It just has to exist a split second before the crime is committed. But when you see this crime and you hear all the circumstances, the evidence is going to show that aforethought existed for a while. It existed for a while in the mind of Alec Murdoch. You're also going to hear about circumstantial evidence. And a lot of times people hear, oh, it's just a circumstantial case. But the law says otherwise. The law says that circumstantial evidence is just as good as direct evidence. And what's the difference between the two? Direct evidence.
So what's interesting is they're almost both sides kind of admit certain things and eat the bruises, as we say, and take the ammunition away from the other side. He says there's a lot of circumstantial evidence in this case, but that's okay. We can get to our burden of beyond a reasonable doubt with circumstantial evidence. And I think it's important to explain that to the jury, because nobody's going to tell the jury that circumstantial evidence is not enough.
Especially about a storm out here, from what I'm told. Direct evidence is if it's sunny outside, and a witness goes outside and it's sunny, and they come here and they get on that witness stand, and because they saw it raining, they sit on the stand and said, I was just outside and I saw it rain. I saw it rain. That's direct evidence. They actually saw it rain. But to give you an example of what circumstantial evidence is if the witness goes into a room where all the curtains are drawn, and when they go into that room, it's sunny outside and everything's dry. And while they're in that room, they see it darken behind the shades. They hear thunder. They hear the wind blowing. They hear the sound of raindrops on the roof. And then they open up the door, and it's not raining, but everything is wet. There's puddles in the driveway. There's puddles in the street. There's puddles in the yard. There's limbs down all over the ground. And then they come in here and say, yeah, it was raining. Didn't actually see it raining, but those circumstances are beyond any reasonable doubt that it was actually raining. Now, I guess it's possible that somebody could have been standing outside the window and beating the drum to sound like thunder and blowing a fan to make it seem like it was the wind and somehow got enough water to coat the entire neighborhood. But that's not reasonable. Everybody understand that distinction? That's not reasonable. Another thing, and this is crucial, what you're going to do in this particular case, is determine credibility or the believability of witnesses. So it's your job to look at the evidence, the exhibits in the case, but also the witnesses and decide if it's truthful, if you believe it, if you can rely on it. And the judge is going to instruct you that you can believe one witness against many or many witnesses against one. You can believe all the witnesses' testimony or part of the witnesses' testimony. It's up to you, first individually, and then as a product of your deliberations. And what you're required to do there is just rely on that good old-fashioned common sense. Does it all fit together?
I mean, you guys have seen enough to know by now. He hit all of them using your common sense. Both sides will use that. Use your common sense, right? Everybody wants you to use your common sense. They just want your common sense to tell you something different.
Corroborate. Does it fit with what you would expect? Does it fit with what you expect how real people would act? Does it seem real? Does something seem a little off? Does something seem a little off?
That's interesting, too. So when you listen to these statements, does something seem a little off? And I think that's something smart to kind of put in the jury's mind. Like, are his reactions not what you'd expect from somebody in his situation?
Video statements about Murdoch. You're going to see body-worn camera of him at the scene when law enforcement arrives. And hear what he says. And hear what he says about that night. You're going to hear three recorded statements on video that he gave with law enforcement. And you're going to hear how things progress about what he says, what he says he did that night. Watch those closely. Watch his expressions. Listen to what he's saying. Listen to what he's not saying. Use that common sense. Does this seem right? Does something seem a little wrong?
Nothing damns a person more than their own words. And it seems like we're going to get three or four statements from Alec Murdoch. And his lawyer talks about them too. Just wait till we get there, because that's going to be an interesting discussion.
Something seemed wrong. I mentioned that Maggie was killed with a 300 blackout rifle, an AR-style rifle, a chambered in 300 blackout ammunition. You're going to hear evidence that back in Christmas of 2016, Alec Murdoch over there bought two 300 blackout AR-style rifles. And then not long after that, one of them went missing from Ball's truck. And time went by, and in April of 2018, Alec Murdoch replaced that rifle and bought another one. Three total blackout rifles that they had. One of them went missing years ago, and a replacement was bought. You're going to hear evidence that Paul and his friend were using that replacement gun. They were standing right outside the side door to the gun room of the house, and they were sighting it in, firing down into a field. And the cases were ejecting. The cases are the empty shell from a bullet, and they were ejecting out into the flower bed right there. And then there's a range across the street, and they shot it there, and there's cases ejected there as well. And they were shooting that third replacement gun just weeks prior to the murders, prior to June 7th, 2021, when Maggie and Paul were murdered. And you're going to hear forensic evidence that the cases that were found in that flower bed and the cases that were found across the street at that range were ejected out of the same weapon that fired all the cases that were around Maggie's dead body, that killed her. It was a family weapon that killed Maggie. You're going to hear evidence.
He's taking a leap there because I don't think any expert's going to say he was killed or she was killed with a family weapon. I think that expert, as we heard, and when they had the expert hearing trying to strike him, he's going to say they were cycled through the same firearm and it was the same type of casing that was found on other parts of the hunting grounds or the property. But I'm pretty sure they've had friends bring firearms at the property as well and hunt or shoot or whatever they do out there. So he just said it was a family weapon. So to me, that's interesting because they don't actually have the murder weapon. So, you know, you want to be careful as a prosecutor because the worst thing you can do is make a liar out of yourself when you don't need to, right? You could connect that with use your common sense, the same casings that are all over this family property, yet they want to make it seem like it's not one of their guns, something like that, versus it's going to be a family gun. Just to me, just nitpicking a little bit, which is fine if you want to say that.
And of those three blackouts, the Alibert I purchased, law enforcement arrives at the scene on June 7th, 2021. He can only account for one. He can only account for one. And that replacement gun is nowhere to be found. You're also going to hear evidence that the type of ammunition, the exact brand, the exact model of ammunition that was used to kill Maggie, S&B 300 blackout ammunition and 147 grain bullets, that exact boxes, empty boxes of that ammunition, is found all over the property. The very same brand and model of ammunition that was used to kill her is found in multiple locations throughout the property. And you're also going to hear evidence, the same thing about the shotgun shells that killed Paul. That federal double buckshot and fired rounds were found on the property, as well as Winchester number 2 turkey lens, 2 rounds, and the shotgun that killed Paul. Family weapon, same ammunition. You're also going to hear evidence that about a week after the murders, Mr. Al Murdoch's father had died, Mr. Randolph. And about a week after the murders, he shows up early in the morning at his parents' home, where his mother still is in late-stage Alzheimer's, on Alameda in Hampton. It's uncharacteristic for him to show up early, uncharacteristic for him to show up at all like that. And he comes in, and he's carrying something in a blue tarp, and he takes it upstairs. And eventually, law enforcement finds out about that. And they go upstairs, and they find a wadded-up, very, very large raincoat in a blue color. It could look like a tarp. And you're going to hear evidence that it's coated with gunshot residue on the inside.
So when I first heard this discussion about the tarp and all this stuff or raincoat or whatever, I was like, why is he making this so confusing? I'm not really following what he's getting at here. Then when you listen to the defense, you'll see it's kind of a confusing piece of evidence they're trying to connect, but they want to talk about that gunshot residue. And they have an expert clearly that's going to be a GSR expert.
You're going to hear other evidence of gunshot residue. You're going to hear that there was gunshot residue on Alec at the scene. You're going to hear the evidence that there was gunshot residue on the seatbelt of the car he was driving. You're going to hear evidence that when law enforcement got to the scene, he had gone and gotten a shotgun, Paul's shotgun, and that Maggie's DNA was on that shotgun. You're going to hear other evidence from DNA, gunshot residue, firearms examiners. There's going to be a lot of forensic evidence in this case. I'm not going to get into every single bit of it right now, but I will say that a key piece of forensic evidence that you're going to hear in this case is the cell phone evidence. Alec's cell phone, Maggie's cell phone, Paul's cell phone. You know, this is all amazing technology that most of us carry around in our pockets. It really allows us to do a lot of things and get a lot done. But this cell phone keeps track of who we're talking to, who we're calling, who we're texting whenever we access apps. And every time you do that, there's a record kept in this phone unless it's deleted somehow. And if you're using certain apps, you can even get GPS information where you were when you did that to store it on these phones. You're going to hear evidence about that. You're going to hear evidence that when you make a call and it pings off the cell towers, the location information can be gathered from that as well. And so it allows an investigation to take this and piece together what someone was doing on a particular day, and not only what they were doing, but who they were interacting with and how they were interacting with them. This is going to be crucial evidence for you to say. You're going to hear, particularly Alec and Paul, but also Maggie, were prolific cell phone to the point where Paul's forensic had a nickname for him, by his cell phone usage. Before I talk more about that, there's three family properties I need to talk about. Okay. The first one I've mentioned is Moselle. Moselle in Colleton County. It's called Moselle. It's off Moselle Road. Everybody refers to it as Moselle. And that property is a large, it's a lot of acres. There's a main house on it, and there's a driveway that goes to that main house. But it used to be an airstrip, and there's an airstrip that goes down, and then down the way, just less than a third of a mile away, just a 3-minute walk, 4-minute walk, 45-second drive, is the kennels and the shed that used to be a hangar where Paul and Maggie were murdered. So the main house is just less than a third of a mile away. You can see the kennels from the main house. You can see the main house from the kennels. The family also had a house in Edisto at the beach. And the evidence is going to show that that is where Maggie preferred to stay, particularly in the summer months. She liked the beach. She was not a hunter. She didn't want to be at Moselle. She didn't want to be at the lodge where it was hot and buggy. She liked being in Edisto. And then you're also, I've already mentioned, the house in Almeda, which is where his parents' home. On June 7, 2021, you're going to hear evidence that his father went into the hospital and the prognosis was not good. And in fact, he died a few days later. And his mother was in late-stage Alzheimer's and had that house being cared for by a caretaker. You're going to hear from that caretaker.
Is there a we pause for a moment. We'll be at least just a moment.
Yes, sir.
We'll skip through here. They take a little break. The prosecutor is almost done, and then we'll talk a little bit about his opening before we get to the defenses, and I'll also answer a few questions.
We're talking about the three family properties. Moselle has the main house, kennels slash sheds. The house has a driveway. Kennels also have a driveway. The evidence is going to show that that was actually as commonly used as the main driveway. In fact, the mailbox is by the kennel driveway. Driving right past those kennels with Paul and Maggie. I told you that you're going to hear evidence that Maggie did not like being in Moselle as much as she liked Edisto, the beach house. With that, on June 7, 2021, she came back to Moselle. And the evidence is going to show that she arrived about 8:15. And the evidence is going to show that from cell phones that Paul was there at the house, at the main house. Caliber Doc himself says that they ate dinner. And the autopsy is going to reflect both Paul and Maggie having similar stomach contents indicating that they recently shared a meal together. About 8:30, about 15 minutes after they arrived, Paul's phone starts moving towards the kennels. You're going to hear evidence again.
So, it's another thing. He's talking about cell phone pings. You know, we've talked about this already. He starts talking about where the phones are moving. And to me, he did not lay a very clear picture of the timeline about where these phones moved. I think I put it together as he spoke through all of it. But again, a lot of you pointed out, it seems like this defense team wants to muddy the water. I think they're going to do that with a lot of this timeline, a lot of these cell phone pings. This is far from a clear picture, in my opinion, that's being painted here in opening statements. I do think he's doing a good job, and we'll get to more of that once he finishes.
Once again, the defendant said he was never at those kennels, that he was napping after they ate. And he was at the main house and never went there.
Okay, that's important. He was never at those kennels. He was napping at the main house before they ate, and he was never at those kennels. That's what the defendant says. Let's remember that. Those are his own words.
You're also going to hear evidence about how much Alec uses his own cell phone. It would be unusual for him to be anywhere without a cell phone. At 8:44. 55 seconds, Paul recorded a video. He was down at the kennels because he had been talking to a friend of his. And you're going to hear from this friend because his friend's dog was in the kennels and they thought there was something wrong with the tape. And Paul was recording a video of it to send to his friend. 8:44 and 55 seconds. And on that video, and you'll see that video, and you'll hear from witnesses that identified Paul's voice, Maggie's voice, and Alec's voice. Anyone who would listen, he was never there. 8:44, 55 seconds, there's a video. The evidence will show that he was there. He was at the murder scene with the two victims. And more than that, just over 3 minutes later, 8:49 and 1 second, Paul's phone locks forever. He never reads another text. He never sends another text. He doesn't answer calls. 3 minutes after that video has the defendants at the murder scene with the two victims, Paul's flip phone goes silent forever.
That is a great point. That is really great. Now, does it prove your case? No, but if they can really show that Alec Murdoch was there with evidence from the phone, be it Snapchat or a testimony of somebody who was on the other side or saw the video, if they can actually prove he was there, and 3 minutes later, that phone is never used again, and they're going to get to his wife's phone, never used again, 3 minutes later when he said he wasn't there. That doesn't look good. That's a good piece of evidence by the prosecution. They laid it out very nicely there at the end. Some of the other pings I thought were confusing, but that makes you raise your eyebrows for sure. Not enough for beyond a reasonable doubt, but that's getting us moving in that direction.
And in fact, another communication comes into the very friend that he was talking to the dog at 8:49 and 35 seconds, just 35 seconds later, and he doesn't answer. He never answers another thing forever now. And on top of that, Maggie's phone locks at 8:49 and 31 seconds around that same time, and she never answers another text, never sends another text, never makes another phone call, never receives another phone call. 3 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. 3 minutes after a video shows he's at the scene with the victims. Told everybody he was never there. Credibility, ladies and gentlemen. Credibility. So what happens after that? Well, you'll hear evidence that Alex's phone was conspicuously, he didn't have a lot of activity from about 8:09 p.m. until 9:02 p.m. And if he was at the kennels, which the evidence will show, why is his phone not with him? Why is it not showing activity? But you will hear that at 9:02, all of a sudden his phone does start to pick up activity. At 9:02, he calls, he starts moving. At 9:04, he calls Maggie's phone. Doesn't answer, of course. Doesn't answer. He calls his father, Randolph, who's in the hospital. Doesn't appear there's an answer there. He calls Maggie again at 9:06. Remember, he's just a third of a mile away. You can see it. At 9:06, she doesn't answer. At 9:06, he turns on his car, the Suburban. And he texts Maggie that he's going, be right back. I'm going to go check on mom. And he doesn't drive down to the kennels, even though that's where the mailbox is. That's a common place to meet. Even though you can see it, he's called his wife two times and texted her, and she hasn't responded. But then just drive down there and say, hey, I'm heading. You guys want to go?
To me, I mean, I don't know about you guys, and I'm of the millennial age, but I text my wife when she's upstairs in the room in the same house as me. So I don't think it's unreasonable that, you know, another house, he doesn't just text his wife or call his wife versus driving over there or walking over there. Doesn't seem unusual to me. Again, we're kind of weighing. Certain pieces are really strong evidence and to me very convincing. Other ones are not. Let me know in the chat what pieces of this and what parts of this evidence, is it the experts? Is it the facts? Is it using your common sense, putting this stuff together? What is the most powerful evidence to you as you watch this and you watch the prosecutor describe the evidence in the case? Yeah, people saying, I text my husband in the house too.
What's up? What's up? Right there. You can see it. He then drives to Albina, where his mom's suffering from Alzheimer's. And the caretaker's there. And he starts calling people. He's talking to people. It'll be up to you to decide whether or not he's trying to manufacture an alibi. He comes. He gets there to Albina. You'll hear evidence about whether or not that was usual. You'll hear evidence about how he was acting when he got there. And he's only there for...
So real quick, Toots. So, but if he doesn't hear back... His dad was dying. His mom has Alzheimer's, a lot of stuff going on. I don't know if I would have noticed that my wife didn't text me back immediately if I told her I was going to my parents' house when they were dealing with all this. But they say here, and here's an important point, a piece of evidence. When he gets there at an unusual time and he's acting very strange by the other people that are in that house or that see him after this, he's acting very strange. That to me could make a difference, depending on what they say, of course.
Yeah, for 20 minutes, because he's back underway at 9:44. And he makes more phone calls on the way back. Calling friends, calling people who will answer. Be up to you to decide whether he's trying to create an alibi.
And I like how he says, it's up to you to answer, is he trying to create an alibi? That's called argument. But he couches the argument here, because opening statements are not supposed to include argument. He couches it in saying, it's up to you to decide, is he trying to create an alibi? And I love that phrase. Is he trying to create an alibi? Get the jury thinking. The defense is going to come up here and tell you about all these alibis, how it couldn't have been him. It wouldn't have been him. He wasn't there. He was with these people. And you've already put it in their mind that he was creating an alibi. Now, there are some other questions coming through the chat because a lot of us know about some of Alex Murdoch's history of what he's done or been accused of doing. But without that knowledge, connect all these dots. With that knowledge, I'm having a hard time not connecting all the dots, right? Somebody asked, isn't it true he tried to plan his own suicide or murder? It's like, allegedly, we'll see, but it's hard to not connect those dots when you do have some context.
And he gets back to Moselle at 10:01. and calls 911 at 10:06. Listen to that 911 call. Listen to what he says. Listen to what explanations he may offer. You're going to hear that 911 call, but you're also going to see the body-worn camera arrive at the scene. The video camera they wear, so it records what they're doing. And you're going to see what he did to Maggie and Paul. Tony Grissom.
He has no qualms about what he did. The evidence is going to show he did it, and that's powerful. Not afraid to look over there and tell you, I know you did it, and we're going to prove it in this trial that you did it. Tough, strong prosecutors like to do that.
No other way around. That's what he did. You're going to see crime scene photographs. You're going to see the dramatic injuries that were suffered. You're going to hear from a pathologist to examine the injuries. That's going to be worse. No other way around. On that 911 call, on the body-worn cameras, pay attention to what he says. Look at how he's acting. But he says within a few minutes of each one of those, he says, this is about the boat case. This is about the boat case. And you're going to hear some of what was going on in Alex Murdoch's life leading up to that day. Stuff that happened that very day, stuff that was leading up, a perfect storm that was gathering, much like the storms that are coming outside today.
So actually, I'm going to speed it up to see if we can read, or I'm going to back it up just 1 second to see if we can read the defense attorney's lips. But he said, we're going to hear about stuff that was happening. And that's about as far as he goes. Because there's been one gaping hole throughout the entirety of this opening statement. And I've been following some of you. I didn't pull all of them, but Rayanne, what did he say the motive was? Chow, did he say a motive? Steven, I hope he gets to motive. I'm going to need that to know why a man would kill his son and his wife. And many others of you wrote in here, Kristen as well, do you think the prosecution's theory for motive is sound or reaching? Well, he doesn't really get into motive because they agreed to not talk about certain stuff during opening statements. So throughout the entirety of this, we're just supposed to believe that this guy who we shouldn't know anything else about blew his son's head off and murdered his wife in the most gruesome of ways. And we don't know why. So if a juror doesn't know anything about Alex Murdoch at this point, they should be asking about a motive and trying to figure out why the heck would he do this? And that was the closest thing, in my opinion, from when I remember when I listened to this, that was the closest we got to motive. And we're going to rewind it real quick to see if, the defense attorney said anything once he started talking about the motive.
Storm that was gathering, much like the storms that are coming outside today. Listen for that evidence.
I can't really tell what he says.
Listen to that gathering storm that all came to a head on June 7th, 2021, the day the evidence will show he killed Maggie and Paul. This has been a long, exhaustive investigation. It's going to be a fairly long trial because it's complicated. It's a journey. There's a lot of aspects to this case. There's a lot of factors. But life, a lot of things that are complicated, and you start to put them all together, piece them together like a puzzle, all of a sudden the picture emerges and it's really simple. It's really simple. Once we get to the end of that journey, you have a chance to deliberate. The evidence is going to be such that you're going to reach the inescapable conclusion that Alec murdered Maggie and Paul, that he was the storm, that the storm was coming for them, and the storm arrived on June 7th, 2021, just like the storms that are heading here right now, that they died as a result, beyond any reasonable doubt.
So that ending was kind of the motive here, right? I'm going to get to a few questions now. Dolores, is it true being from a family of lawyers and judges, he thinks he owns the county? Did you see his reaction at the end of the day and his Tic Tacs? I did not. I don't remember his reaction at the end of the day. Apparently, he did have some kind of control over a lot of people in this county, but that has all gone belly up. Valerie, with him being a lawyer, wouldn't he know how to contain his behavior? And there are a couple comments on this, and my buddy Dom, who is a lawyer in the area, also texted me. Did anybody think it was weird that he wasn't wearing a tie, being an attorney? Did you guys think that that was weird and how he didn't dress for the part? Was he trying to dress down? Listen, he can't seem like he's not the elite of the elite right? The Southern Belle, a male version of whatever that is, with all of his houses and his hunting grounds and his guns and, you know, his generational money. They're not going to make him seem like a common man here, but he isn't wearing a tie. And did any of you think that that was interesting? And Just Juan said, why isn't his emotion or lack protected by the fifth? So that's interesting. You can control, like you can say, I invoke my fifth amendment right. And then if you start talking, that can still be used against you. So whatever he does and projects can be used against him. The warning is, if you do it, it can be used against you. So if he reacts or doesn't react, now they can say, we've told him, and a lot of people said in here, potentially this is one of the things that happened. We've told him to try to control his emotion as much as possible. Lawyers can say things like that. If he takes the stand, he can say something like that. Lisa, do clients that are lawyers make the worst clients, like doctors make the worst patients? Usually the answer to that is yes. I always think I'd be a great client, but the answer to that is usually yes. Donna D, what is he writing? Is the defendant taking notes? Yes, especially if he's a lawyer. I mean, he can take notes. He can aid in his defense. He can give them ideas. He can say, this isn't right. We have this document that disproves what he said, things like that. Carsto, hey, Peter, are the opening arguments, statements, the first time each side really hears what the focus of the other side's presentation to the jury will be? It's the first time they hear it laid out in the way that the other side wants to do it, but they're not surprised because they've done deposition. They've gotten discovery. They know who the experts are. They know what the expert testimony is going to be. They've seen the videos. They've heard the defendant's statement. So they know what's out there. There's no surprises. It's just kind of like the way that they're laying it out. They get to see it for the first time, how the prosecutor wants to explain it. Beth, do they have to talk about motive and openings? Absolutely not. But all of you are listening to it, or a lot of you are listening to it, asking for that motive. So if you had a good motive, I wouldn't save it. I would talk about it in opening. The defense is extremely graphic. Absolutely, they do. Or they do get graphic. We're going to get to the defense now, and I'll put Lita's comment up here as we hear about how honored these attorneys are to represent Alec Murdoch.
For the defense.
Please report, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, jury, my name is Dick Harpugian. I introduce myself to you all and our attorneys, the three other attorneys, Jim Griffin, Philip Barber, Margaret Fox. It is our honor to represent Alec Murdoch, or Murdoch, depending on how you pronounce it. I say it's our honor because I submit to you what you've heard from the attorney general as facts are not. They're his theories, his conjecture. Now stand up. This is Alec Murdoch. And Alec was a loving.
Very common thing that defense lawyers like to do. It's not my favorite as a defense lawyer or a plaintiff's lawyer to have my clients stand up as I talk about them. What do you guys think? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Is it cheesy? Is it corny? Do you think it looks like too rehearsed? I don't know. I usually don't love it in my opinion. Seems like a lot of you don't either.
Loving father of Paul and the loving husband, Maddie. You're not going to hear a single witness say that their relationship, Maggie and Alex's relationship, are anything other than loving. You're going to hear about how they went to a baseball game the weekend before. You're going to hear about their relationship. You're going to see texts and emails indicating a loving relationship.
Now, I think that's important. That evidence is going to be really important. If we can see a lot of circumstantial evidence that proves it was a good relationship, loving relationship, then it really is hard to believe that he just snapped one day. If you don't know all the other stuff about Alec Murdoch, of course. But it is kind of hard to believe that just like a loving father, regardless of what kind of financial trouble he was in, that would really do this to his family that he loved, that he wanted to protect, that he did so much to help throughout his entire life, obviously. So I like that evidence and the presentation of that evidence. I wonder how it's all going to come in, how many different people are going to testify about this relationship. Some of you said some of his family members are on the witness list, so that'll be interesting. Could be an indication that Alec Murdoch's going to take the stand. I don't think he's going to. But just interesting.
Paul, the apple of his eye. You're going to see a video somewhere between 7:30 and 8 o'clock, the night of the murders, with Paul and Alec riding around looking at some trees they planted. It's a Snapchat Paul sent to other people because the trees were not planted very well. They were cantilevering over. They're laughing. They're having a good time. That would be about an hour before the attorney general says he swatted them. When I say he swatted them, when they were swatted, and no question, Paul Murdoch was shot twice.
If you don't want to hear some gruesome details, mute it now or skip ahead if you've been listening to it slowly or if you're behind, because we're about to get into some gruesome details here.
With buckshot, 12-gauge buckshot, once in the chest. And by the way, that shot would indicate it was in the chest and came out under his arm, like somebody that might have been holding up their hands. So when he says no defensive wounds, he perhaps was being held a shotgun. I mean, I can make the same sort of speculation that the attorney general can, because that's all he's doing, speculating. What we do know is 12-gauge, fairly close range.
So that's just the first little bit of argument. That's all the prosecutor's doing is speculating. That's purely argument. But I think it does a good thing. It puts that doubt in the jury's mind that just because he said it doesn't mean it's actually going to come in like that. Doesn't mean that evidence is going to come in. And it definitely doesn't mean the evidence is or proves what he says it proves. And he says that multiple times, that this is conjecture or speculating. And he says, they said no defensive wounds. But you tell me, if you have your hand up like this, couldn't that be a defensive wound? If you were running away, couldn't that mean you were running away from somebody you didn't know that was hunting you down? So again, I think these arguments are well played.
Shot to the chest. He must have been turned because it comes out under his arm. There's wadding, if you're familiar with the shotgun, under his arm. The second shot ended up, and there's going to be some question about the direction of that shot, but ended up entering his skull cavity, and the gases from that shot literally exploded his head like a watermelon hit with a sledgehammer. All that was left was the front of his face. Everything else was gone. His brain exploded out of his head, hit the ceiling in the shed, and dropped to his feet. Horrendous, horrible, butchering.
Okay, now I will say, I was looking at Alec Murdoch, I'm not going to lie, and I'm a potential juror here as I watch it. It definitely looked like this was brutal to listen to and that he was crying through this. Not much during the prosecutor's explanation, but I mean, Harpulian goes into gory detail, and Murdoch definitely does respond, and he definitely does react. So if a jury is watching it, they will see that.
So to find Alec Murdoch guilty of murdering his son, you're going to have to accept that within an hour of having a extraordinarily bonding, you can see it in the Snapchat, that he executes him in a brutal fashion.
Again, I'm just telling you, I've seen a lot of these cases. I've had a lot of clients. Without more context, that is really hard to believe. Everything's hunky-dory, and then the brutal detail of how the murders occurred just an hour later, you have to think he's an absolute psychopath. Now, maybe he is, but that's what the jury would be saying with a conviction here, in my opinion. They would be saying, this guy is brutal. Is brutal.
Not believable. Not believable. Now, Maggie is shot running. No defensive wounds because she's shot running. And after she falls to the ground and has one bullet that has hit her and probably traveled up and hit her brain, she's on the ground. And whoever the perpetrator was walked up, took that AR, and put one in the back of her head. Executed. Executed. Why? This is going to be interesting because we don't know why. He doesn't know why. He's got theories of this and theories of that. But why? Number one. Number two.
Okay, so for other people talking about the motive, and somebody asked just after I finished answering questions, Kate Carpenter, why wouldn't motive be allowed an opening? It absolutely is allowed an opening. And that's why I said it felt like a hole in the state's argument. I keep calling them the state. It's the attorney general's office. They're the prosecutors. You know, you can track with me there when I call them the state. But that was a hole in their argument. They did talk about the storms and whatever, but they don't know. They tried to get the judge to rule that they were allowed to make that motive argument with the financial crimes. The judge didn't make that ruling. He didn't say they couldn't, but they decided not to argue it in openings or discuss it in openings. And Harpulian is driving a truck through that. Why? You'd have to believe this. Why? There's no reason. That doesn't make sense. Why would this happen? He keeps saying it because he knows that's a hole and hopes that's what the jury's thinking, which a lot of you as representatives here, whether you like it or not, citizens of whatever jurisdiction you live in, you are the voice of potential jurors and you were all asking the same question. I'm going to need motive. What's the motive? And Harpulian picked up that same feeling as he went throughout his open.
What was it in that hour between when he's yucking it up with Paul. And let me say this to you. His record, he was interviewed. He comes home and finds, there's no question about this. They've got telemetry from his car. He left the house at 9:06, returns at 10:01 after seeing his mother who has dementia. Now, remember, that day, his father, who's dying, is taken to the hospital. Mom's home alone with the housekeeper. Perfectly reasonable for him to want to go see her. And later than usual. His father's not there. He's in the hospital. He dies 2 days later. His father dies 2 days later. So the question,
no doubt a lot going on. And if you don't know about all the 75 plus charges that Alec Murdaugh has in addition to these, that storm that the prosecutor was talking about, you may think it was his mother with dementia or Alzheimer's, his father who was dying. You know, maybe that's what you're thinking this storm is. So maybe the prosecutor's going to hammer it home later. This is the motive. And then closing, it's going to be a hurrah moment. But as it sits right now, I think people are asking why.
The question is, if he leaves at 9:06 and he's back at 10:01, he literally, I mean, and he can account, the cars and the cell phone records account for where he was between 9:06 and 10:01. Now, the cell phone records, and you're going to hear this from their own experts, are incomplete. They're incomplete. And we're going to submit one of the reasons they're incomplete.
I love when defense attorneys say something is incomplete, like a police report or the cell phone records incomplete, as if that means, so everything we have couldn't possibly be legitimate or reliable because they're incomplete. It's like, well, if you're missing like 5 minutes, that doesn't mean the other 55 minutes of the hour are wrong. It just means you don't have that 5 minutes. So sure, we don't know what's going to happen in that 5 minutes. So, but I love when they say incomplete. Could you believe something is incomplete? We shouldn't believe any of it then.
And by the way, how do they find Maggie's phone? Maggie's phone was thrown out on the side of the road about a quarter of a mile away from, a little bit more, maybe a half a mile, from the Moselle property, thrown out on the side of the road. They found it by using Find My iPhone. And the way they did that, they had to open it or have access. Who gave them the code to open the phone? Now, Murdaugh.
What's funny as well is, so he cooperated. And while defense attorneys hate when their clients cooperate, you better believe if they do cooperate, they're going to let the jury know he cooperated. He helped them find the iPhone and open up with the code or whatever to get in. He didn't, he could, he must be innocent because he cooperated, even though we all direct our clients not to cooperate because you'll see how his statements get used against him and are probably going to be damning. Just wait till Harpulian tries to tiptoe his way around some of the statements Alec Murdaugh made.
And it's not destroyed. It's just thrown on the side of the phone. What you're also going to see is that Alec Murdaugh was calling that phone at 9:06. As he leaves the house, he did call her twice and texted her. And we also know that at 9:06, as he cranks his car, as the cell phone records show that, as the telemetry data from the shows the cell phone linking up with the car, that phone is being thrown on the side of the road almost a half a mile away. Now, that is convenient. That is magic. That is inexplicable. Now,
that is magic. And some of you said there's no way he did all this in 10 minutes. He would have had to change. He would have had blood all over him. He would have had gunshot residue. Those are the reasonable doubts that the state is going to have to dispel if they're going to win this case, no doubt about it.
I was making notes what the attorney general was talking about. But let me tell you what is more believable. The night he comes home and finds his wife and son butchered. And when I say butchered, you're going to see these photographs. When I see them now, after having seen them for the last 4 or 5 months, it still shocks me. It still is tough to look at. It still bothers me. And he comes home and finds his son laying in his own blood with brain laying at his feet, shot to hell. He walks over, he checks to see if there's any life there. Although, I mean, he's seeing his brain laying outside his body. He knows there's nothing there. He goes over.
This lawyer is tough, right? I mean, he seems thick skinned, like he's been through it all, seen it all. He says this without, I mean, there's no hairs across his tongue. He even says, I might be a little bit rough. Don't hold that against Alec. I mean, this guy is just like, I mean, obviously he knew he was dead. There's brains all over the ground. It's like, oh man, talking about a guy's 22-year-old son. You know, I mean, I'm much different than this presentation when I represent Kate. Now, I usually am representing the victim, so I'm about as sympathetic towards them as you can be. But even when I defend cases like this, try to be a little more sympathetic. And you can tell when he starts talking about the guns, he like doesn't want the jury to hate his client because of all the gun stuff, because, you know, the politics and whatever that comes with that. So just wait till he kind of fumbles over that just a little bit, because he's like, well, you know, some people like guns.
Friend tries to get a pulse out of Maggie. No pulse there. Calls 911. I want you to hear that 911 tape. It is a man hysterical in grief, trying to figure out what's going on. And he tells the 911 operator,
I don't know what just happened there. Can everybody see me and hear me now? Let me know if you're with me. Say yes. Holler if you hear me. I know a lot of people saying retro. Okay, yes. Okay. All right, I'm back. I don't know what just happened. I got booted from my own studio, but I'm back. All right. All right, good. We're good. We're good. No harm, no foul there.
Third of a mile. Maybe by the way the pro flies, but it takes a little bit longer to drive down there.
I'm going to back it up a little bit.
You can't see. I've been out there. But he concerned.
All right, I'm going to back it up just a little bit because this is when he's talking about how not necessarily close these two places were. And as the crow flies, they might be that close, but not if you're driving or walking there. Okay. And then he does something that's a little sneaky, a little inadmissible that we'll talk about in a second, too.
I want you to hear that 911 tape. It is a man hysterical in grief, trying to figure out what's going on. And he tells the 911 operator that he concerned and he drives the back up to the house. By the way, you can't see.
So first off, another one of my favorite things when we watch these cases together is the prosecutor says, well, we're going to play this 911 tape for you. And the defense is like, well, we want him to play the 911. If they weren't going to play it, we were going to play the 911 tape. Right? I love when that happens too. And they're like, no, that's not their evidence. That's our evidence.
I've been out there. You can't see the shed where you might see the top of the shed. There are pine trees between the front porch or the porch on the house and the dog pens. And it's not a.
So he says, you can't see it from the front porch from the house. I've been out there. That's literally counsel testifying. That's telling the jury something is a fact based on your own experience as the lawyer, which you absolutely can't do. But I don't think we heard a single objection. Actually, we did. The state objects or the prosecutor objects here in a minute. That's the only objection. They did not object to each other much. They're going to let each other argue. They respect each other. I can tell. These two sets of lawyers have a lot of respect for each other. They're going to fight hard. They're going to fight tough. They're both going to try to win. They both seem to believe in their side and their argument, which is what is going to make this case so interesting to watch. Potentially the best set of lawyers. I know a lot of you don't like him. Potentially the best set of lawyers that we've watched do a trial. Potentially. And they have the Southern kind of feel to them. So it's a different kind of set of lawyers. And I think it's going to be interesting. So a lot of people don't like him. Okay. All right. I understand if you don't like him, but I would have absolutely objected. I don't care who he is. I don't care if it's the best lawyer in the world. I'm objecting when he says, I've been out there. Say, objection, judge. Counsel testifying. Is somebody else going to testify to that?
Not a third of a mile. Maybe by the way the crow flies, but it takes a little bit longer to drive down there. And this is not unusual for them to communicate by cell phone or text, even when they're all on the same property. It's 1,100 acres. Big property. 800. So what I'm trying to say to you is that the attorney general has given you his view. And again, you can't see the shed. And I'm going to ask the judge at some point during this trial to ask you, the jury, to be able to go to the scene so you can see it. You can understand the court.
Another thing. I'm going to ask the judge at some point in this trial if you can go to the scene. So if they don't get to go to the scene, they're going to think the prosecutor or the judge didn't let them because the defense really wanted to let them to go to the scene. Again, this is kind of... I don't want to say underhanded, but this is kind of gamesmanship here. You're not supposed to do this. You're not supposed to tell them you're going to ask for things that might not get allowed to come in because the judge finds a valid legal reason not to allow it. People hate this guy. Okay. All right. I don't think he's bad. And I'll just tell you, for any of those that think that he's like really biased toward one side, he was the top prosecutor in his jurisdiction. For 20 plus years, he was a prosecutor. All he did was put bad guys away. So I just want to say that.
You can understand the details. Because the facts are what matter here. The facts. Let me give you another fact. You're going to hear their witnesses explain catastrophic injuries to Paul. His head literally exploded. And whoever shot him with that shotgun was probably no more than 3 feet away. Maybe closer, maybe a little further away. His head exploded. He would be covered in blood from head to foot. In blood.
This is why he's explaining the gruesome detail, because there should be blood everywhere on everything.
He just closed that night. So I did. And they checked. Well, first of all, you're going to see in the videos from the agent, the officers that arrived that night. There's no blood on him. They didn't find any blood on him. Sled's testing indicated 12 different places on his shirt and pants. No human blood detected. Period. Okay? You'll see pictures. One t-shirt. No blood on it. Those are facts. Those aren't theories. Those are facts. Another fact is, I think, the reason we're here today. When you hear those questions on the videotape on the night, now he's found his wife and son brutally butchered. You can hear on the 911 tape, he is hysterical. He comes in and out. It's consistent. If any of you have ever, you've got to use your human, your experience as part of this deliberation process, your human experience, you've ever suffered the catastrophic loss of a friend or a family member, it's numbing. It's the minute you find out, if you see them dead, it's numbing. You go into shock. So anything
he wants them to use their common sense as well. He doesn't, it's not just the prosecutor that wants to use their common sense. But here is interesting. So he was in shock, right? He was in shock. And now he's going to try to explain away some of the damning things that Alec Murdoch said. And I don't know all of this stuff. I haven't seen the statements. I haven't seen the body cam footage. So I'm just saying the prosecutor really likes what Alec Murdoch says, and he wants them to hear it. The defense is going to try to give some excuses as to what he said may not have been the best.
He said that night is in the context of just an hour or two before finding his wife and son butchered. He drove back up to the house while he's on 911 saying, I got to get a gun. Whoever did this might be out there. He gets a gun. What's fascinating about that is he gets a 12-gauge shotgun, and he grabs some shells. People hunt a lot. They have guns everywhere. He grabs some shells. He puts a 16-gauge, a 12-gauge, grabs a 12-gauge shotgun, put a 12-gauge buckshot in, and then he put a 16-gauge buckshot in. That's how shook up he was. Guy hunted all his life, and he put a shell in. He couldn't fire a 16-gauge with a 12-gauge. Makes no sense. He was traumatized.
And it proves the trauma. He put the wrong ammunition in his shotgun. He's a gun guy.
GSR, their own expert, as Sled said, the amount of particles of GSR are consistent with that, him going up and picking that shotgun up. You want to talk about GSR? Again, if you fired a shotgun twice and a rifle six times, you'd be covered in GSR. Those are the facts. That's not his theory. The facts. Now, let's talk a little bit about these ARs. Again, you're going to hear testimony. A lot of guns. They had a gun room. I don't live in Calvin County. I live in downtown Columbia. Ain't no gun rooms.
I don't live in this county. Again, he's testifying. I don't live in this county. I live in downtown Columbia. I'm not in gun land. I don't have a gun room. So don't hold it against Alec Murdoch that he has a gun room. Doesn't make him a bad guy. That's what I feel like he's arguing here.
Columbia. But apparently if you live on 1,100 acres, if you hunt deer, and you hunt whatever they're planting, those sunflowers, you have a lot of guns. Proof is, in 2017, hear the testimony that Alec bought two blackouts, one for Paul, one for Buster. There's other stuff sitting out in the audience. And Paul had one just stolen. He bought another one for Paul. Now, Paul was very irresponsible.
Kind of concerning that, like, guns are getting stolen off your property. And did he just say Paul was really irresponsible with his gun?
With guns, cars,
Paul was really irresponsible with gun cars. So Paul's the one that got the BUI where people died. But talking about his deceased son like this, I mean, I guess they're going to blame him why there are casings everywhere, how maybe it could have been one of Paul's friends that he loaned a gun or Paul left a gun somewhere. Kind of strange that he goes in on the irresponsible nature of the deceased 22-year-old son. And if he is so irresponsible, why are you buying him gun after gun? If my son, I mean, I'm not buying my son a gun. If I did and he lost that gun, definitely not buying him another gun.
Leave guns around. He leave guns in cars. He oftentimes left guns down at the dog pen.
Sheesh.
In the feed room. Now, I can't tell you whether he was shot with his own weapon or not, or his mom was shot with his weapon or not. But I can tell you that they weren't shot. They don't have the guns. There's no way to tell conclusively without having the weapons what weapons those were fired by. And we'll be talking a bit with the sweat experts about that. The sort of overarching issue here is why murder on June 7th, 2021. Why is it September of 2022 before they charged him? And we'll tell you what happened that night. This is a problem. He's questioned, and the questioning is pretty aggressive. You'll hear. He's traumatized. They suspect him. They show up. He's got a shotgun. They suspect him. And the next morning, two people found butchered and here in Calhoun County, Moselle Road. Police announced, don't worry. There's no danger to y'all. There's nobody out there that could pose a danger to you. Because you see, they decided that night he did it. Without forensics, without cell phones, without any of that. And they've been pounding that square peg in the round hole for the last, since June of 2021. Holding the charges in September. And so, if he felt, and he did, and you'll hear it, the accused story fashion he's being interviewed in, he may not have dealt all the facts. But by the way,
hold on. Do you see how quickly he glazed over that? Here, hold on. There was a comment that I started here from the beginning from Ashley. The prosecution said that AM repeatedly said he wasn't at the sheds. I didn't like how the defense said, well, it doesn't really matter if he was there or not. Lying about that certainly does matter. So he's like, this is what Harpulian says, and I'm going to rewind it again just so everybody can hear it. He's like, so listen, he was feeling like, you know, it was accusatory. So while he did kind of cooperate with the cops, maybe he didn't give them all the correct information. Basically admitting some of the things that Alec Murdoch said was not true, which in my opinion, I don't really care how good of a lawyer you are, how good you are at giving excuses or trying to explain away certain things. That's a tough one for the jury to swallow. And I expect the prosecution to continue to plow through the credibility of witnesses and the credibility of Alec Murdoch. So let's listen to him explain that away one more time.
Fashion he's being. And so if he felt, and he did, and you'll hear it, the accusatory fashion he's being interviewed in, he may not have dealt all the facts. But by the way, whether he'd been down to the dog pens that night or not, really doesn't matter. Really doesn't matter.
So he may not have told the truth, but even if he didn't tell the truth, it doesn't matter. Which could be true. That could absolutely be a correct line of thinking. No doubt about it. Even if he was there earlier and then left and then somebody came while he was gone, that's absolutely plausible, could have happened. But it does not look good that you have to admit that you lied to police because you didn't want them to arrest you for this.
Because you're going to see cell phone activity that would be, let me put it to you this way. Paul's phone, 850. Maggie's phone, later than that, 854. Clearly, it's still being used. At 906, he's up at the house getting in the car, cranking it up to drive over and see his mom. He says, a few hundred yards away, it's a bit further than that. But the point of the matter is, he would have had to have executed both of them, got back up to the house, got the bloody clothes off. And by the way, they seized his clothes on that night. They never searched his house for any other clothes that we know. Although that night, he gave permission and they got a search warrant. Go to my house. Go look through everything. Where are the bloody clothes? Where are the bloody clothes? And of course,
a lot of direct evidence is missing, right? And that's what you have to present to this jury if you're the defense team.
I would tell you that they've woven this story together because they want everything to be consistent. What's important about that is the judge, and by the way, there's no eyewitness. There's no forensics tying him to the murder. When I say forensics, fingerprints, blood, whatever, tying him to shooting anybody that night. The cell phone records would indicate he would have had less than 10 minutes to kill him, get up to the house, get in the car and crank it up, maybe covered in blood. Now,
clean up, get rid of the clothes, get rid of the gunshot residue. I mean, that's tough to do in 10 minutes. Again, I think these are all really plausible arguments. And Jenny makes a good point. Do you think he could have hired somebody to do this? Well, I wish I didn't know about all the past of Alec Murdoch, because absolutely, I think he could have hired somebody to do this. He could have even given him the gun to do it right when he left. He could have, but it doesn't seem like there's any evidence of that. And the state or the prosecutor is saying Alec Murdoch himself did it. They are not saying he hired anybody. He is not charged with conspiracy. He is charged with first-degree intentional homicide himself by his own hand. So while I think that's a plausible thought, Jenny, the prosecutors are not going with that.
If they think he was beginning to establish an alibi, there's no evidence of that. The evidence is consistent with him seeing them earlier at the dog pen. And by the way, that audio they have of him and Maggie, They're talking about one of the dogs killing a chicken. And they were debating whether it was a guinea hen or a chicken. No animosity. Very normal discussion. Paul's very happy. We know that Paul, after that, is texting back and forth with a girl about going to the movies. Nobody's down there threatening him. Daddy's not pulling out a shotgun and killing him. For, you know, 10 minutes after that, he's texting this girl. So, big question. One shooter or two? Two dog guns, shotgun and an AR. And by the way, Maggie has no defensive wounds because she's running.
That just is very strange to me. So if it's one guy with two separate weapons, again, this was all planned out, I guess. That's what you have to believe, that he planned it out. He was trying to throw off the cops. He shot with two different guns, got rid of them. I mean, that's another weird twist in this, is that it was two separate weapons.
Where's she running from? And could you shoot? Typically, she had a little shed right, probably 150 feet from the feed room on the other side of the wall. Perhaps she heard the shotgun blast and came around and saw somebody, or two people, and whoever it was opened up. Was there enough time to kill Paul, and then find the AR and then ambush Maggie. Much more likely there were two people. But again, we don't have to prove anything.
That's purely all argument. Much more likely there were two people, but we don't have to prove anything, right? Defense attorneys get a little more leeway, but he's right. I mean, I think they're going to be able to make a good argument that this was two people. Now, the state could overcome that, but that's these are the types of arguments we expected them to make. Other suspects, multiple suspects, lack of evidence, lack of motive, alibi. These are all the things we hit on. We were doing the trial prep for this, and the defense is going exactly how we thought. And I think this motive evidence by the state, can they get into all of the other financial crimes that were brewing like the storms that are coming? Because if they can, it's a lot more likely he gets convicted. If they can't, I think there's a chance that Alec Murdaugh might actually win this case. And Mr. RN, I have heard this theory thrown around. Now, this wouldn't help him because if he, I mean, I guess self-defense, but it would be very hard to kind of switch gears at this point and trying to do this. Rebel said, he's creating doubt, no doubt. There's a lot of people commenting. He's guilty of sin. He's going to get convicted. It's going to be quick. So it's far from a slam dunk on either side so far.
Let me sort of share the framework in which you should examine this. You have agreed to follow the law. And here's the law. Here is the law. He didn't do it. He is presumed innocent. As you sit there right now, when you look at him.
Defense attorneys have to do this, and I actually really like the way he presented this. The law is he didn't do it. He's innocent as he sits there right now, and he continues. This was a really good, I think he's getting close to the ending.
You have to believe he is innocent. He didn't do it. Now, let me tell you, that's so difficult to do. I get it. And the best way to explain it is this. This morning or yesterday, nobody really reads newspapers anymore. But if you're reading the newspaper, looking at the internet, you read the police arrested somebody for some heinous crime. The natural inclination of everybody, all of y'all, is to say, thank God they caught him or her. Thank God that person is in custody. And you did something that's so natural. We all do it. You presume the police had arrested the person that committed the crime. You presumed him or her guilty. That is the natural thing to do. And you know what? That's fine for you to do. Any other day except today. Because you took an oath to follow the law. And the law is, he is innocent. He's presumed innocent. That is your presumption. Your mental framework is, he didn't do it. They got to prove it to me beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what's even more difficult, and this isn't a contest, this isn't a game, this isn't who wins and who loses. This is about justice. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the justices of the Supreme Court, once said, jury duty is the highest duty a citizen can perform for their country in peacetime. Because you are protecting us from them, from the state, from the government. That's the foundation of our Constitution, is that the individual has a right to be presumed innocent, has a right to a jury trial, has a right to have his or her peers instead of judgment of them. That's you. And the framework is you presume him innocent, and you cannot convict him until the state proves to you beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt. And a reasonable doubt is the kind of doubt which would cause an ordinary person to hesitate to act in the more important decisions in their life. Now, what makes this even more complicated is there's no direct evidence. There's no eyewitness. There's no camera. There's no fingerprints. There's no forensics tying him to the crime. None. None. I say that without any fear of contradiction whatsoever. None. And what the judge is going to tell you is, to the extent the state relies on circumstantial evidence, the circumstances must be consistent with each other, and when taken together, point conclusively to the guilt of the accused beyond a reasonable doubt. If these circumstances merely portray the defendant's behavior as suspicious, now this smoke they've created is about suspicion. I mean, if you show up at the scene and you got the wife especially dead, and the guy's got a shotgun, you know, it's pretty logical for the cops to jump to a conclusion. He did it. And the problem is that as they came to that conclusion, they have pounded that square peg in the round hole, and you're going to hear about it. They've ignored some witnesses. I mean, for instance, that blue tarp showed up with a blue tarp. That witness who said he showed up with a blue tarp was shown a blue rain jacket that he talked about. Said, that's not it. That's not what he brought here that morning. I mean, I talked to her. He says, no. It was a blue tarp. And what was it?
There we go. Finally, an objection to him testifying. He's been testifying throughout the entire opening. The judge sustains it. He says, I talked to her because I guess it seems like it wasn't an official deposition, but that is confusing. And I don't think that witness is going to be very good for the prosecution based on the defense's explanation. And even the prosecution's explanation about a tarp or a raincoat or whatever it was, it's confusing. It's not clean. Objection sustained, which lets me know this judge would have sustained every objection the prosecutor would have objected as Harpulian testified throughout this opening statement.
I would tell you that the testimony you're going to hear is inconsistent with the attorney general representative based on interview
argument
by other than me. So what I'm telling you is this, that as you sit here and listen, every time there's a witness takes that witness stand that the state's put up there, you see, you judge credibility, whether to believe a witness or not believe a witness, whether to believe one witness against many, many against one. You're going to have to evaluate the testimony you hear from this witness stand with a critical eye. Critical eye. I mean, if you've got uncontested scientific evidence, accept it. I've got no problem with that. The cell phone records you keep talking about, I would say to you, are not necessarily accurate to the extent of a lie. I will also tell you that there's going to be a bunch of people, and I will have been promised something or threatened with something, that may take the witness stand and say something. But I tell you what they're not going to say. They're not going to say they saw him kill him. They're not going to say that they were involved in it. They're not going to say anything that would give you a comfort level in their testimony. All of you vindicated, follow the law. And I say this one last time. He didn't do it. He didn't kill Butcher, his son and wife. And you need to put from your mind any suggestion that he did. Been picked, said you could be fair. You were picked, said you follow the law. You were picked because Alec Murdaugh believes that you can be fair. Now, if during this process over the next however long we're here, I say something or do something, it's most certainly based on what I will do, irritate you or anger you. That's rough. Don't hold that against Alec. Hold it against me. If I say something that offends you in some way, don't hold that against Alec. Me. Remember, as you sit there right now, in your mind, he didn't do it. He is innocent. He require a verdict of not guilty from you. That's the law. That's your oath. Thank you.
All right, so that's it. They don't call any witnesses. They just get through openings today. It was interesting. And we have posted the poll, which one you thought was better. We didn't put an equal. We didn't put a neither. A lot of you in here are saying a lot of different things and coming kind of from both sides. I'm going to get to a lot of your questions and comments now. But first, Leslie P., this hit home for me. Riddle me this. What happens when you speed up a Southern opening statement to 1.5 speed? It becomes normal speech. It kind of felt like normal speech to me, if I'm being honest. And if you can't tell, I speak a little quicker than these guys with the Southern draw, even though I live further south than them. Florida's not really the deep south like South Carolina. Ashley, he's tall. Shouldn't they be able to tell the trajectory of the shots? Didn't like how the defense said it didn't matter if AM was at the kettle, lying matters. Yeah, I saved that comment from you. Yeah, they should be able to, and we'll see how much they talk about that based on his height and things like that. CMC, do you think Alex will take the stand? So a lot of people are saying, is it Alex? Is it Alec? The defense already said different ways to pronounce Murdaugh and Murdaugh. I've been told by sources in the know it's Alec Murdaugh is the appropriate pronunciation, so I'm doing my best to stick with that. I don't think he will take the stand, not just because this case, but also because of all of the other crimes he is accused of. And this can be used against him in all those other cases as well. So if they start getting into any of that, he can't plead the fifth on that and not on this stuff. So it's difficult. Vanessa, money equals motive. Sure, because we know a lot about Alec Murdaugh, and we have even seen, some of us, the hearings where they discuss what they believe the motive is. But the jurors are not supposed to know that right now. And the state did not say that that's the motive in opening. A storm is brewing, but they didn't say what that storm was. So as the jurors went home tonight, they do not know what the motive was, in my opinion, unless they have been doing some other kind of research. Lisa, we hate defense attorneys. Well, we all don't, because they are defending accused actions that are indefensible. I love you, Lisa, and I'm happy you're here. And I like to have these discussions and disagreements, but I 100% disagree with everything you put in your comment. We don't hate defense attorneys. Our system needs them, especially for people that are wrongfully accused or innocent. It happens all the time. My buddy was just telling me about a trial. He's a not guilty trial today. Ag bat. They're defending the accused actions, and they're not indefensible. Many of them are defensible. It's important we remember that. Dana, I don't mind either of these attorneys, but I don't need to hear motive for murdering a grown son and wife. Seems like a messy way for someone like Murdoch to kill his own family. Ready for evidence. Thanks for covering, Peter. I agree, Dana. We need to see the evidence. Because at the end of this, my mind is far from made up, which of course means... So I'm gonna save this question until the end of the video. All right, Sandy D. I like his delivery because it doesn't sound rehearsed. His confidence gives his presentation credibility. I agree with you. Incredibly confident. Lisa, have his prior bad acts been restricted from this trial? Some of them, he's got so many prior bad acts. Some of them will absolutely be excluded from this trial, but it seems like some of them may come in. So we will have to see. JLL, you've probably been doing this for a long time, but I've just recently come across you, referred to you by Duty Ron, who's awesome, and Grizzly True Crime, who's also awesome. Thank you for doing this for your viewers. Truly awesome and appreciated. Also, I'm a Floridian too. Where from, JLL? Thank you so much for the super chat. Thank you for joining us. And I like that people are watching kind of these different angles, right? Grizzly True Crime brings an angle. Duty Ron brings an angle. And I bring a different angle. And I think it's fun to kind of see different cases from all different perspectives and learn from each other, right? That's why I love this chat. And I love getting into these questions and comments so much because it gives a broader context of a different way of thinking, diverse questions, diverse thought, diverse backgrounds and experience really makes this so much more educational for everybody involved. Susan Elaine, random, but could he have talked Paul into taking mom out and then taking Paul's life? Not sure if it's been said who was killed first. Again, these theories are all over the place. And to me, it's up to the state. If this happened, the state's going to have trouble proving their case because that's not what that's not what the prosecutor said happened, Susan. So that's important. If this was what happened, the prosecutor should be proving beyond a reasonable doubt that this is what happened. Kristen M. And to me, a lot of you with these kind of comments are thinking you're not necessarily buying what the prosecution is selling, that Alec Murdoch did this himself to these two family members of his. Kristen, the property was put up for sale. If it has, can't find if it has, sold, would the new owners allow a field trip? Could they have torn down the buildings? You can force entry upon land. I don't know if it's been sold. I don't know if they've preserved it as a scene for some kind of jury view. I don't know that answer. Lita, spouse is usually the suspect. What motive would anyone else have to kill them both? That's a good question as well. A great question. And I think this is great discussion kind of for the jury room while they would be deliberating. A lot of people have been talking about divorce, how they've heard, you know, rumblings or whispers that there was a divorce or that she met an attorney. The prosecutor did not say that and didn't have that as a motive. And the defense said there was no issues with their relationship. So again, we can't bring that other stuff in here, regardless of what we think we know from his other cases, other hearings, anything else, any other reports. If the prosecutor doesn't put on that evidence that there were problems in this marriage, then we should not, as potential jurors, mostly you guys, should not take that into consideration when discussing your vote. Caitlin, in my opinion, people's judgment is clouded by feelings. Defense opening substantially more influential than the prosecutor. Peter, what do you think based on opening statements only? I would give the defense the edge on opening statements. I thought they were both good. And I think both of these lawyers are good. I know people are going to disagree with me. I think the prosecutor is really good. I also think the prosecutor's hands were tied a little bit more than the defense attorney's in opening. And the defense attorney was able to use some of the judicial rulings more than the prosecutor was, which is not uncommon. Defense attorneys are given more leeway all the time. John, send me the poll results when you get a chance. Stephanie Coker, will the jury get to hear about him hiring someone to shoot him so Buster and not his wife and other son could get the insurance money? No, I don't think they're going to. Actually, I shouldn't say that for sure because I don't know. I would be very surprised if that evidence came in. And if it was going to come in as in the opening statement, I would have said, and if you think it's so hard to believe that he would do something so outlandish, you don't even know the most outlandish thing that he's accused of doing. He's also accused of doing this. K-Rab, did defense say the evidence will show even once, or did he just testify? He did a little testifying. You don't actually have to say the evidence will show, as the judge reminded us. You don't have to say magic words oftentimes, right? But he absolutely said, you're not going to hear this. You will hear this. This is what's going to happen. The blue tarp's going to be this. The gunshot residue is going to be this. So he did make a lot of arguments. He did testify a little bit, but he laid a roadmap as well. You don't have to actually say the evidence will show. All right. Right now, the vote is the prosecutor, 60%, the defense attorney, 39%, and we're at about 1,000 votes. Last I checked, we were at about 1,600 likes. Let's see if we can get the likes up to like 4,000. We got 4,500 people in here. Let's get the likes up to 4,000. Thank you, Suzanne Martin. Hit that like button and let your friends know if they're following this case to come here for the recaps and to get their questions answered. If you're new here, I'm a trial lawyer in Tampa Bay. I handle mostly personal injury plaintiffs work now. I've done a lot of criminal defense in the past and I prosecuted cases early in my career. So got a lot of different kind of experiences to bring to the table and talk through these cases. Mary Malarkey, I thought AM killed his wife first. I now believe it's the other way around, which is so much harder to deal with. Interesting. What makes you believe that? Megan, Peter. Peter, okay. I live in the country in Texas. We keep a spare gun in the barn for snakes, fox, hogs. I think two guns, one person would be possible. Now, Megan, could be possible, but do you think it's actually what happened? Do you think they proved it? Stephanie Coker, why didn't the prosecution object to him saying some of the witnesses were under suspicious reasons? I don't know. Prosecutor really didn't object a lot. Azam, my free time is up. I have to leave. Joining Rewatch crew later. Thanks for staying up late for this. Peter, have a good rest later. Thank you. Yes, it's almost 10 o'clock. We're almost done here. Myra, I didn't understand how defense attorneys could sleep at night until I learned how many people are wrongfully accused, especially marginalized people. Big time. Big time. At the end of the day, justice is what's important. Absolutely. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We got to believe that. We got to protect people who can't protect themselves. I mean, that's really what it comes down to a lot of times. Sonia Slater, thanks from a Northwest Florida gal. You rock. Question, was the jury not sequestered? I may have missed that. Thoughts, they are not sequestered. I don't think that sequestration would really help in this case. The judge telling them not to look at this stuff, if they could have already seen it, it was already going on in huge, huge waves of media attention prior. So if they hadn't seen it to this point or they had been reasonable enough to where everybody picked them to be on the jury, I think they can continue to do their job now throughout this trial. Lisa, let me rephrase my point about defense attorneys. Good. I agree everyone is entitled to the best defense possible. It's hard for us lay folks to hear someone trying to defend some hate crimes. 100% agree with you. 100% totally cool. And this is the forum for that. This is the forum for you to kind of talk through your feelings and understand why you think and feel and believe the way that you do. Understanding that if you're ever picked for a jury, you need to put all that aside and just listen to what's in front of you. Golden Girl, your thoughts on this trial being held in this tiny county where his family has lots of pull and everybody literally knows everybody? It's interesting. I thought a lot more potential jurors would know him than did. Selena, former person he put in prison equal motive. Someone he stole money from equal motive. Many people other than him have motive. Good point, but are we going to hear any evidence of that? The defense doesn't have to put on any evidence, but if I had a motive for somebody else that had opportunity and could be a suspect, I would put it up there. And I think you make a couple good points there. Thanks, Jeannie Nash. Be kind. Random murder does happen though, right? Absolutely. I mean, if you think about the kid that we covered the case that he was not guilty by reason of insanity, he was found like eating people's faces off. He went and murdered two random people sitting in their garage. Super sad, but also super random. JLL, I'm in Tallahassee, Florida. Go FSU, my second favorite city in Florida to my own, of course, Clearwater. The only other place I've ever lived for 7 years. I'm a double grad from FSU. And maybe you and John, my media guy, are going to have a watch party. He's in Tallahassee too. Megan Dreher, I live in Texas. We keep a spare gun in the barn for snakes, foxes. Having a person with two guns is possible. Okay, I think I already read that one. Jamie, with his finance and drug issues and his family status, who's to say it's not someone he screwed over? When more than one people in the chat comment something similar, I would be shocked if there was not at least one juror that was thinking the same thing, if they know all that context, right? They might not know all the shadiness that was going on in his life. I see you, JLL, go Noles. Lita, Why would the prosecution and defense even bring the tarp jacket up in opening remarks? The jury hasn't even known what they're talking about. Do they? I agree with you, Lita. I don't think I would have said it if I was the prosecutor. I don't think it added anything to his opening. And your understanding, Lita, this is what lawyers have to do, right? We practice this stuff. We go through this stuff. We try to pick the most important stuff that paints a picture and tells our story. Sometimes we add too much. Sometimes we leave a little out. Sometimes it doesn't come off like we expected it to or like we practiced, and it just doesn't hit as hard as we expected. For the defense to bring it up, I think it makes absolute sense because it's kind of a conflicting or confusing piece of evidence that doesn't really prove anything, but the prosecutor acted like it was this big deal. So I absolutely would have brought it up as the defense. Welcome, Aaron, and a lot of new members tonight, which is really fun. For crime's sake, without defense attorneys, the system would collapse. There wouldn't be a system, right? There wouldn't be a system. Think about grand juries and how often they do indict people that they bring because there's no defense. Leona Eddie, thank you for the super sticker. George the Cat, what kind of accommodations do they make for jurors with disabilities? Depends on the disability. If it's like a back issue, they can stand up, have a pillow, special chair, things like that. If it's a hearing issue, they'll put headphones in, translators sometimes. They do a lot. Mary Malarkey, Peter, EDB shared image of the shell locations and bodies. Yeah, there are a few different diagrams of them. I don't have one to share, but that's cool that she did. That's probably helps to understand it. And I think we'll see that throughout the trial. I like to see how the lawyers present this stuff, and it really adds to it because a lot of times we can kind of think and pull up stuff, how we would use it or think about it. I love to see how they actually do and how it comes across to the jury. Cynthia, I came into this thinking Murdoch was guilty, but the defense's opening statement has me second guessing. I like the defense lawyer. He is old school. Cynthia, here's the point. If you listen to him, actually, this is going to transition me into my final question. I was going to have John do a poll, but instead I'll just have it in the comments or in the chat. After those opening statements, what is your verdict right now in the chat? Type it in the chat. Is it guilty or not guilty? How would you vote right now after opening statements? Post it in the chat. And as you're posting that, I'll answer another question from Don. What did the son Snapchat video have on? It seems like the point of the Snapchat video is to show that Alec Murdoch was by the kennels or whatever. It's hard for me to even like envision a hunting property or whatever, but it proves that he was by the kennels when he said he was not. It's impeaching. All right. So a lot of you have commented here. Thank you, Brittany. A lot of you said, I don't know, which is fine. But a lot of you just got the answer wrong. It was a bit of a trick question, and I may ask you this throughout. So I see a lot of not guilties, and I see a lot of guilties. It almost feels like 50-50. People that are saying, I have questions, that's not guilty. Everybody, the answer is, and if you listen to Harpooly and the defense attorney, the answer right now has to be not guilty. No evidence has been presented. What the lawyers say is not evidence. This is a trick question. So if anybody's upset, I understand. It's a trick question, but legally he is presumed innocent still. Not a single shred of evidence has been produced before us, potential jury members. So it has to be not guilty. And I'm sure a lot of you are telling me, if all of that evidence comes out, I would vote for guilty, which I understand, and that's fair. And the ones that said, I don't know, that's got to be a not guilty. If you don't know, it has to be not guilty. That's the way our system has to be set up. We have to be sure if we're going to put people in prison for the rest of their life. A good mix. I would say maybe a little more than 50% lean to the not guilty side. Here we go. Yeah, good. A lot of you have been listening, so that's good. Yeah, definitely more not guilties here later in the chat. So good. We're going to continue learning. Everybody, we are going to continue learning. And I appreciate your questions. And of course, I will pose some of my own as well. Okay, Deborah B. said undecided, which means not guilty. If you can't decide, it has to be not guilty. T. Sky, is the prosecution allowed to present more than one theory of what happened, i.e. either he hired someone else to do it or he did it himself? No. They have to prove whatever the charge is beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they don't have evidence of that charge, then they shouldn't even bring it. Prairie Dog, what if it was revenge from the boating accident against the Paul and Maggie just happened to be in the way? Could be. All these theories are possible. Yep. Steph Morris, she wasn't going to get tricked. Innocent until proven guilty. Brittany Wist, this proud West Coast courtroom clerk finally caught alive. Awesome, Brittany. I love what I do and what I get to be a part of even more. How about a shout out to all the clerks out there holding down the fort? A lot of people don't know, it's like the clerks run courtrooms in a lot of jurisdictions. They can be the boss. We got to be good with the clerks, right? The lawyers, like, hey, I always try to talk to them at breaks and before and get to know them. And there are some that I really like. There are some that watch this YouTube channel, which is amazing and so cool that this YouTube channel has had that kind of reach. But they're amazing and they can help so much, keep the process smooth, keep us in order, keep all of our evidence where it needs to be. Carmen L, either side might only appear good on opening statement because no hard evidence is presented. I want to see the evidence. Great point, Carmen. And when the evidence hits you in the face and proves, makes you a liar or makes you someone that's telling the truth, it's really important. Karen, welcome into the membership crew. All right, we went overtime already. First night, we actually had something. So I appreciate everybody for joining in. We're going to call it for tonight. Hit that like button. Let's get up to 4,000 likes before we sign off from here. Let me know what you thought if you're new here. If you just subscribed from the Murdoch case, let me know in the comments by putting Murdoch case. I appreciate everybody so much for joining us. This is a lot of fun. It was a very interesting and educational conversation. Now, the content is never fun. I say that all the time. We deal with difficult content, and difficult cases, but you guys make it really enjoyable and educational, and that's really what I appreciate. Emily, prepping a list of specials, PI paralegal. Woo-woo, you're prepping. I don't know where you are. I was going to say this late. PI paralegals, man, the backbone. Good ones are hard to find as well, and you got to keep them when you find them. Awesome, Emily. Thanks for the comment. All right, I am out of here. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Lawyer You Know podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, which I hope you did, here's what to do next. Give it a share, rate, and review the show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, and make sure you subscribe to the show in the listening app of your choice. Follow me on all social media platforms at Tragos Law and join the Lawyer You Know YouTube channel and community where you can ask me questions live on all of these cases. If you've got an idea for a specific topic or you have a personal legal question on an injury case, whether it's a car accident, trip and fall, wrongful death, or catastrophic injury case, please email me at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. All of these links I just mentioned are included in the show notes section of this episode. So until next time, I'm Peter Tragos.